In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Right now in America, there's an epidemic of vast proportions, and it is everywhere you look. No, not the panic-demic that has been pushed on Americans, but that is one of the symptoms. The epidemic I'm talking about is an epidemic of distrust. You would think that something so central to humanity as trust is, and as vital as that is to society, you'd be right to think that it is or should be a concept that is fairly well understood by the various academic fields by now, psychology, social sciences, and even in business and politics. But there's actually a good bit of disagreement on it, especially in the area of how exactly and why trust forms in the first place, and how to regain trust once it's been broken. In fact, back in 2014, the Marketing Science Institute was calling for new research into this very area because they weren't satisfied with the current models and research and found them to be lacking. Now, think about that for a moment. The Marketing Science Institute, an industry which routinely abuses the word free, wanted new research into trust formation and how it can be repaired. Putting that aside, it's true. Researchers still struggle to nail down the ins and outs, the how and the why we trust some people or institutions. But the funny thing is, you don't need to be an academic researcher to know when trust has been broken. As I said, there is an epidemic of distrust, and there should be. It stems from the top. Our own government is betraying our trust on a daily basis. When they lie about data, when they lie about their solutions, it's not just government, it's everywhere. The media, corporations. How many people would leave their kid alone at a Disney daycare knowing now what we know? How many people trust the schools now or the teachers in them? On today's show, we're going to be talking about constitutional issues, but at the heart of it, it's really all about trust. I'd like to welcome back Jonathan E. Mort. He is one of America's top constitutional attorneys. He's also the author of the book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. If you want to know how the land of the free got to where we are today, you definitely need to read The Authoritarians. I seriously cannot recommend that highly enough. Jonathan, with everything going on, it is great to talk to you again.
It is great talking to you as well.
Thank you so much. And so dominating the news this last week was the leak of the majority opinion from the Supreme Court that would likely, at this point, overturn Roe versus Wade. In the opinion, Alito wrote, quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. And Politico, which published the leaked opinion, called it a full-throated, unflinching repudiation of the 1973 decision, which guaranteed federal constitutional protections of the abortion rights, and a subsequent 1992 decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that largely maintained the right. So lots to unpack here. Do you see any of the judges who put their name on the majority flipping and joining Chief Justice Roberts, who apparently wants a more stepped approach to doing away with Roe?
Well, I think that it is a draft opinion, and it undoubtedly will change. We don't have the dissents from Politico. We just have the majority opinion. We don't have the concurrences, if any. So, but assuming that it remains largely the way it is, and I think it probably will, I think we can count on those justices who are in the majority to, if anything, be more steely in their resolve to maintain their position in light of what has happened than not. I think that it is a fiasco on the left, and it's likely to have no effect on altering their opinions one way or the other, I would suspect.
So the ruling, if it holds, would be a pretty momentous decision. Do you agree with Alito that the 73 court got Roe egregiously wrong and that it should be thrown out?
Yes, I agree with that. They also overturned Casey. I agree with that. There are no such things as penumbras in the constitutional scheme of things, and the creation of a right of privacy on the federal level is whole cloth creationism. There was no contemplation by the founding fathers of application of federal law to peculiarly local health and safety issues. The matter of abortion was dealt with on the local level during the colonial period and the founding period. It was not understood to be a federal matter at all. There's no word abortion in the Constitution. There's no reference to any kind of a right to an abortion. So as a consequence, it's neither a pre-political right that one would recognize consistent with Lockean conceptions that the Founding Fathers believed in, nor is it anything that actually appears in the Constitution. So the proper resort for people who would like to have abortion addressed in the Constitution is Article 5 Amendment, to seek a supermajority of the states to vote for it. Otherwise, what happens when you do such a thing is create a new constitutional right or establish a new constitutional power. You break that trust, which is underlying the Constitution, as the second paragraph of the Declaration makes clear, which is the consent of the governed. Hmm. So whether it is Congress, the President, or the judiciary that violates the Constitution to achieve what is a end they desire, they do so by usurping power that is not theirs, it's the people's, and to achieve a change of this sort, you have to do it by constitutional amendment. George Washington made that very clear when he said, "Let there be no change by usurpation, for though in one instance it may be an instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which pre-governments are destroyed."
Yep. I think that usurping of power really shows the lack of trust right now, because when they're stealing power that isn't theirs, you know, how can you trust them? And, you know, we've got so many examples of this right now. We've got the abortion debate going on right now, where they had to apply all of these constitutional gymnastics really to arrive at that. But now you've got things like the Ministry of Truth that we're going to be talking about later. So as far as this ruling goes, if Roe is thrown out, what does that mean? How will America look post this decision?
It really does nothing to the state landscape. So states that are predisposed against abortion, wish to constrict abortion, will continue to enact laws to do that. States like California that disagree will keep abortion widely available and legal. And you know, people will have to decide one way or the other, and will vote for politicians at the state level to address it. That is how the Constitution leaves it. And as I say, if there's a wish to change the allocation of power on this issue from a health and safety issue, which is under our federalist system left to the states, in the ordinary course, they have to do that by an Article 5 amendment. And to do it otherwise is simply a usurpation of power that violates the Constitution. And if you do it in one instance and it's left unchecked, then you can obviously manipulate the Constitution based on that precedent in numerous other ways that these individuals themselves may not like. So if you actually believe in individual rights, you should, and think that there is a right associated with abortion, you ought to be cognizant of the Constitution writ large and its allocation of powers, because that very much determines a protection for our rights. And in this case, it's left to the people. So for those who want a right to abortion, they can go argue that cause politically, and they can seek to amend the Constitution if they wish. For those like me who believe that life begins at conception, I would be opposing that on the state level. But there is no federal jurisdiction on this question directly under the Constitution.
Hmm. And so many of us have been saying that abortion is not a constitutional right for many, many years. Okay, we do need to take a break. Come back. We'll have more with Jonathan Emord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Jonathan Emord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys. Lots to talk about with him, with all that's going on and so much of it unconstitutional. We're going to cover as much of that as we can today, the GAO report, the Ministry of Truth, and so much more. So, Jonathan, in that previous segment, we were talking about abortion, and since this news broke with the leak, with the majority opinion, there has been no end of hysteria on the left that this is going to mean back alley abortions again and hangers and all the rest. So I can't help but wonder if some of the hysteria is that in the left's mind, they have now removed this constitutional right to an abortion. Does that then also kind of impact what they are seeing as a right to health care, that somehow that's also in the Constitution? And by removing this supposed right, now it deflates the rights they have to health care.
Well, of course, there is no constitutional right to health care.
Right.
There is obviously the Bill of Rights is directed against government. So it doesn't empower government. It takes power away from government. Yes, in one sense, if you allow the creation by the court of rights that don't exist in the Constitution, why then wouldn't you allow the creation by the court of powers that don't exist in the Constitution? So by that illogic, tripping themselves over the Constitution, trying to destroy it and change it, they may proceed that way. I think all the reaction has actually been very counterproductive for
yes.
their cause.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that, as is the case with every political movement, in order to garner sufficient popular support for your cause, you really do have to appeal to the great silent majority in America, which induce them to become vocal. And what they have done instead is offend that great silent majority, which has no understanding why hysteria, why protesting in front of the justices' homes or creating an enormous spectacle is somehow persuasive. They view that as offensive, and rightfully so. So apparently these people are more interested in their opinions being in somewhat of a far left echo chamber than they are in persuading those who may be ambivalent or who may be in opposition to them. They should take a strong opportunity to study Martin Luther King's approach, because Martin Luther King greatly understood that awakening a silent majority is the way to achieve political success in the United States, and he did it masterfully and brilliantly.
Yes.
So an articulate argument. And the problem that they have is that in the end, they really are in so many ways advocating infanticide. When
yes.
they
oh,
advocate partial birth abortion, for example, there's no question but that that's infanticide. And when they advocate having a term beyond conception, where increasingly technology makes it possible for the fetus to live outside the womb,
mm-hmm.
it becomes very, very hard to argue. If they were to argue that, for example, a mother ought not be required to give birth to a stillborn child, that ought to be aborted, be given the right to abort, they would have more sympathy, obviously. If they were to argue that a child who would otherwise be brain dead at birth, or who would otherwise have no heart function, or would have genetic defects that would cause the child to die within a matter of hours after birth, all of those things would be far more palatable to the majority of Americans, me included, than this idea that you ought to take a child and give an unrestricted right all the way up to birth for the mother or the father or the parents to abort is outrageous. And that's why Chuck Schumer's bill went down to ignominious defeat. It's because they just inevitably grasp for the extremes.
Right.
And doing so necessarily alienates people. They got away with it during the pandemic. There was this fog of fear and indecision, in addition to the spread of the disease, and much license was given to that far left majority to rule, minority to rule. but not anymore, because people are coming out of it. They're realizing that they have been tricked and hoaxed and abused, and their rights have been violated, and they're not willing to tolerate this radicalism on the left. And I think that's cropping up all over the country, and it's a good thing.
Absolutely. I think one of the more horrific bills that I have seen in my lifetime is a bill that has passed through some of the committees there in California, where they want to allow mothers to kill a baby up to 1 month after birth. I am just floored that anybody can even think this way.
It's barbarism. And it's, you know, these very same people were years ago complaining about the one child policy in China and how grossly abusive that was of the population. Well, when it comes to looking themselves in the mirror, they don't, because they prefer to instead advocate this extraordinary position, so extreme, and obviously a violation of a human right. I mean, even by any definition of life, once a child is born and is viable, it has rights in this country. And to what they're advocating is the murder of a citizen, a child that has been born. Now, those of us who believe that life begins at conception think that there's a state interest in protecting that life, and that life ought to be paramount as the state's interest. And that when you water that down and you allow for circumstances in general to just be governed by a whim or a caprice rather than a careful reflection on the rights of that fetus to have life, you end up with really a very, very horrible situation where the state condones the sacrifice of children. We have to, these are the most innocent of all of us, and we have to protect them. Yeah. We protect them in the law when they're children ordinarily. We, not so much in California, because they are allowing child abuse in schools, CRT, and this fluid gender political position to be propounded, sexualizing children at kindergarten through grade school. That's child abuse.
Yes.
And ordinarily, the state would stand as an additional source of protection for the rights of the child against such abuse, even if it came from a parent or even if it came from an outside source. Now the government is not only backing, as you point out, in California, the idea that a mother has a right to abort a child even after it's born, but also this idea that the state has a right to indoctrinate children in Marxist theory, radical racism, and also in this idea that their genders aren't set by birth but and by God, but rather are fluid and can be whatever they want, and that the state will assist them in having taking hormone suppressive drugs and having grotesque surgery to modify their genitals to be an opposite gender.
Right, and so much of it too is without the parents' knowledge or consent on that. It's just absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, time for a break. If you suspected COVID data and scientific findings might have been altered or used for political purposes, turns out you were right. And believe it or not, a government agency agrees with you. We'll talk about that next with Jonathan E. Morton. And welcome back. We're talking today with Jonathan E. Morton, author of The Authoritarians. He's also one of America's top constitutional attorneys, and with the government running amok and ignoring things like the Constitution, there's a lot to talk about. So, Jonathan, I'd like to switch now to this report from the Government Accountability Office. It was issued in late April, and it found that four agencies, the CDC, FDA, NIH, and ASPR, had no policies in place to handle the politicization of scientific findings. And from the report, it says employees at CDC, FDA, and NIH told GAO they observed incidents that they perceived to be political interference but did not report them for various reasons. The reasons included fearing retaliation, being unsure how to report such issues, and believing agency leaders were already aware. That is really worrisome, in my opinion. They saw that science was being politicized but were afraid to report it. It goes on to say, some of the respondents believe that the potential political interference may have resulted in the politically motivated alteration of public health guidance or delayed publication of COVID-19 related scientific findings. So That breakdown and fear may have caused lives being lost because politics got involved and reports were muzzled or altered to fit a narrative. Jonathan, you fought the FDA and know about corruption there. When an agency like this is so big and has been so corrupted, are there answers to changing it, or does it just need to be torn down and start over?
I think it needs to be torn down, and I wouldn't start over. I would redelegate the situation. The way it would work would be to have a statute that would authorize private institutions, principally universities, to conduct research to evaluate the safety and efficacy of drugs under a statutory standard and in a blinded manner so that the Justice Department would assign applications to specific university-based institutions or private institutions for this evaluation that met criteria for evaluation. They would perform testing and evaluate it and then would have a confidential report they would then issue to Justice, and then Justice would announce the determination. It could be the subject of litigation if a party had reason to suspect it was erroneous and so forth. But that type of a system would have been far preferable to what we have now, which is political appointees operating over the selection of scientists and the evaluation of things. This idea that is in the GAO report of political interference with science is an old story. I remember in the 1990s, this began to become manifest as whistleblowers were leaving the FDA, coming to Congressman or Senator Chuck Grassley's Finance Committee and explaining that there was this corruption at FDA, that they, even though they were medical reviewers who had found drugs to be unsafe, their positions were overruled consistently in favor of the drug companies, and that there was tremendous corruption within the FDA. And as now we see also in the CDC with the way in which the whole gain-of-function research issues were dealt with, Dr. Fauci is terribly corrupt, and the evidence of that is overwhelming. These are politicians who are masquerading as scientists, and they're really very interested in their own financial interests as well. When it comes to the FDA commissioners, there's a long history of FDA commissioners choosing sides in these battles for approval of drugs and then leaving the agency and becoming employed or becoming on university chairs financed by the very companies that were benefited by their actions while they were at the FDA. The political corruption was really blown into full color by Dr. David Graham, who is the associate director of the FDA Office of Drug Safety, when in the case of Vioxx, he came before the Senate Finance Committee, again Grassley's committee, and he explained that that anti-inflammatory drug was allowed to be remain in the market by the FDA despite overwhelming evidence of heart toxicity. And he famously said, "I would argue that the FDA is currently configured is incapable of protecting America against another Vioxx. We are virtually defenseless," he said. And that is really the problem here, because you've got the agency is basically a patsy for the industry.
Right.
And you even have correspondence revealed to Congress that shows that heads of the the Office of Drug Safety and the Drug Approval System at FDA have variously over the years colluded with executives in drug companies to water down public interest in adverse effects. You know, so they have helped basically served as a government-sponsored PR operation. And, you know, so there's a lot of this going on. There have been whistleblower after whistleblower. And here's the sad reality. Every member of Congress who has any influence over the jurisdiction of the FDA receives a handsome amount of money every election cycle from the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association and other associations tied to the drug industry. And that financial connection and political clout of the drug lobby on Capitol Hill is overwhelming. So much so that Dan Burton, who used to chair the Government Reform and Oversight Committee, said that any bill that the drug industry wants, they will get, because virtually no member will oppose the drug industry because of this financial control. So the corruption hits Congress, and that's why, even though there have been hearings after hearings after hearings detailing this corruption with whistleblowers communicating the details from inside the agency and the abuses, the very clear corruption present, there has been no legislation, none, to revise or reform the agency in ways that would prevent this type of corruption. FDA drug review panels that are appointed by the commissioner frequently have members on them that have very clear and profound conflicts of interest in favor of the drug applicant, and the FDA commissioner routinely waives those conflicts and allows them to sit there. And largely, I mean, you find over and over again, if they happen to, despite all the packing of these panels, refuse to approve a drug, it's often the case that the FDA commissioner will overrule the panel and simply either approve it directly or recreate another panel that will approve the drug. So it is the case that we are virtually defenseless, as David Graham put it back then. I don't know what his opinions are now. He's still there, but that's what he said. In 2004, he said that.
The corruption is just astounding. It really is. All right, time for a break. We're talking today with Jonathan Emord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys. Coming up, we'll have more on the GAO report. And coming up, how's that Ministry of Truth even remotely constitutional? Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today with one of America's top constitutional attorneys, Jonathan Emord. So, Jonathan, in that last segment there, we were talking about the GAO report. And, you know, I would like to think that this report starts to crack the egg in terms of getting to the truth of COVID and the politicization of science and so forth. And we certainly saw that with COVID being used as a political weapon. And then you're talking about there have been no bills to revise or reform any of what is going on. So that gets a little discouraging. Do you see this report as maybe the start of something, or could be the start of something, or is it just, well, that's nice, but we're just going to ignore it anyway?
It'll largely be ignored. Anything that will be done, it will be probably very much superficial. Politics reigns supreme. You can't have it any other way in a situation like this. So much money is involved, so much concern from Congress, so much political influence from the political appointees at the agency. It's really impossible to prevent these institutions where politicians reign over science to not have politics interfere with science. It's just the nature of the beast, and they'll do it one way or another. For example, FDA commissioners frequently will be involved in reassigning medical reviewers when a medical reviewer provides a preliminary report of their findings to a supervisor who's politically appointed in the agency, and the supervisor finds the report to not be in favor of the drug. If the commissioner wants that drug, then the person who's assigned will be reassigned, and another person will be put on with a full understanding implicit in that reassignment that the new person's coming on board because they were dissatisfied with the report of the prior person. This kind of nonsense goes on regularly. It is a horrible game in which the American people are at stake, but they have no political clout before the FDA. FDA, like all agencies of the government, responds to the political control above and has virtually no concern for the effects of actions by the agencies on the American people. And the American people, of course, with drugs are most directly affected. So it's no coincidence that in America, over 100,000 people a year die from drugs that are properly prescribed. There just isn't an FDA that is protecting their interests. It is the case that the FDA protects the drug company's interests first and foremost, and that is the way it has always been with that agency. since the Kefauver amendments in the 60s gave them that power.
Well, I definitely agree with your recommendation that it just needs to be scrapped and start over. You do hold the record for defeating the FDA 8 times in federal courts, and you have personally seen how the FDA has approved drugs, despite knowing that drug companies have lied about and even faked entire clinical trials. A few months ago, Pfizer tried to hide their COVID vaccine data for 75 years. It's not hard to figure out why they wanted to hide it for that long, but was that a first? 75 years for disclosure? And do drug companies normally try that hard to hide things from the public while telling the public, trust us, it's all good things in here?
I believe it is a first, but it is the case that, as I mentioned, there's quite a bit of collusion between the agency and its preferred drug companies in protecting those drug companies' interests. So in this case, you know, these adverse effects are substantial.
Yes.
for the COVID vaccine that Pfizer produced. And yet the agency was mum about it, didn't tell the American public, didn't tell political leaders that there is this concern, and in fact didn't perform any research to help assess the extent to which these adverse effects may be mitigated by excluding from vaccination certain segments of the population. So they have been really a servant of the drug industry and not of the American people in this regard. And their suppression, their willingness to keep from the public this information and from politicians is an example of just how tight the connections are between the drug industry here, Pfizer, and the FDA.
So one of the things that is coming out, one of many things that are coming out with these the release of this data from Pfizer is that, as you said, that they have a tremendous amount of adverse effects. There was a lot more deaths during the trials than what they had led people to believe. So if that if that's clearly fraud, could that finally crack the shield of immunity that they currently have?
Well, creative arguments can be made, but unfortunately for us all, there is this virtual blanket immunity from litigation that Congress has given the drug industry in this instance. And, you know, it's very hard to get through that, but I'm sure there's some way to do it. There are creative attorneys around the country who might be able to come up with a way. In the end, I think what we really should understand is that the vaccine was touted to be a cure-all, and we know it is not. We certainly know that. There's no evidence now that it did provide a blanket protection for people. Many people who are vaccinated got COVID. We understand that the vaccine wanes within a matter of months of, significantly, within a matter of months of you getting vaccinated, such that the boosters now may have 1 or 2 months of immune protection that they afford that is significant enough to prevent you from getting a particular kind of COVID-19 infection. But overall, it's been really a failure. COVID has done what COVID would do. Really, COVID has done what COVID would do, largely unaffected by the vaccinations.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fulsome natural immunity appears to be the most accurately described and fulfilled promise of science.
Yeah.
The scientists said that this is likely to happen, that there would be a natural immunity acquired, and that would be fulsome, and that people would suffer perhaps mild illnesses from that point forward.
Which was
said for the vaccine, but not so.
Which is exactly what Oxford had said right from the beginning: is just let herd immunity take place, and that'll be, and we'll be out of this in a matter of months. But unfortunately,
virtually everybody had the variant that's name is escaping me at the moment. It ripped through the American public, and a substantial number of people, both vaccinated and unvaccinated, acquired that illness. They acquired from that very fulsome immunity, and as a result, those people are largely protected. That is why we continue to see the incidences of hospitalization and deaths hover at very low levels, and we're in the endemic phase. We're no longer in a pandemic.
I mean,
it's an extraordinary achievement, but it has cost an enormous number of lives, and really, we ought to be blaming Fauci for that.
Well,
we ought to be
absolutely
looking back at these people who thought they were willing to experiment and create this monstrous thing and allow our enemies, facilitate our enemies, the communist Chinese who are dedicated to creation of a bioweapon, to use their facilities to develop this thing. And then we suffered.
Yep,
I mean, the blood on their hands is just, look how many people have died.
Yeah, it's astounding. And not only astounding, but somebody needs to pay for it. People have to be accountable. They absolutely do. All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, Biden's Ministry of Truth. Hey, welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Emord. He's the author of The Authoritarians, and he's also a top constitutional attorney. And we've been talking today about constitutional issues and really about trust, lack of it, because the government seems to see nothing wrong with lying and manipulating. So, Jonathan, the height of gall in the modern era has to be the same government that has no end of lies about COVID, about Russia, about Trump supporters, about the quote-unquote most secure election in history, that worked with and paid media and social media to spread their lies. After all of that and thousands of other examples, they have now decided to set up a new Ministry of Truth under the Department of Homeland Security, no less, the same agency that is supposed to protect us from terrorists. You know, it would be appropriate if they were setting up to police government lies and interference, but instead they're going after alternate news sites and whatnot. So as a constitutional attorney, does this pass constitutional muster where our own government is now policing information?
Not by a long shot. It's very clear that it doesn't. Content-based review or censorship of speech is forbidden by the First Amendment. You can't create a institution with unbridled discretion that reviews private speech offerings and determines what is and what is not okay. And as a result, it violates the First Amendment. It's so clear, in fact, that you would have to overturn so much precedent in order to justify the existence of such a thing. It's just ridiculous. So I find it preposterous that anybody would even conceive of such a thing. But of course, we exist in an environment in which people are not respecting the Constitution who are in the Biden administration, including the President of the United States, most notably. So they grab for power unconstitutionally. He gets whacked by the courts over and over again, and yet he continuously does this. This is an effort to try to protect the Biden administration from attacks that will result in losses in the midterm elections. He's going to lose anyway, but he wants to be able to do what he had the opportunity to do because of collusion with the administration, with the Democrat Party of big tech. And then, lo and behold, along comes Elon Musk and blows the party. They don't want the truth to get out. They're particularly concerned about what's going to come out further about Hunter Biden and the president's complicity and influence peddling and payment from our enemies to accounts out of which President Biden drew in order to pay his mortgages and other expenses. They don't want that information to be focused upon. They don't want his compromised status to be a focus. And they certainly don't want to lose in the midterm elections. So they're willing to sacrifice America's speech rights and your right to access information and the central role, checking value role of the First Amendment to check government for corruption and abuse of power, because they are, if anything, 10 times worse than Richard Nixon ever was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I do find it rather interesting that this Ministry of Truth is announced and put into place just as more information is just coming out about the use of COVID for political reasons. So we've got that GAO report, and also more information coming out about the vaccines is coming to light. So could this ministry be challenged in court, or does it need to be challenged by Congress? How do we get rid of this?
You could act in Congress by denying the funding for the Disinformation Governance Board and DHS. You could also sue, and as soon as they begin this process of censoring any information, you can count on it. Suits will be prolific because this is so ripe for attack. It's not even funny. This is one of the most gross violations of the First Amendment in American history since the Alien Sedition Acts in 1798. This is not something that the courts are going to stand. It is something that will be civil libertarians who are liberal judges will find it offensive, as well as those who believe in the original understanding of the Constitution. It's going to go down in flames.
Oh, I certainly hope so. All right, everyone, stay with us. We're going to take a break and then wrap things up with Jonathan E. Mord, one of America's top constitutional attorneys. Coming up, we're going to be asking him about that new film, 2,000 Mules. Stay with us. And welcome back into our final segment now with Jonathan E. Mord. He is a top constitutional attorney, one of the best in America, and he's also the author of the book, The Authoritarians. We will link that up on iSpyRadio.com. I highly, highly recommend that book. If you want to find out why America is in the situation that it is, the answers are in there. So, Jonathan, a new movie on election fraud was released, 2,000 Mules. I have not seen that yet. I plan on seeing it when it premieres here in Salem this coming Monday. And this movie, from all reports, it truly demonstrates how they stole the election, using mules to deposit hundreds of thousands of ballots, fraudulent ballots, oftentimes in the middle of the night. So what happens if this fraud can be proven? What happens if these states now decide to decertify their election? Does it even matter at this point?
Well, I think it'll be very hard for any of these states to decertify elections. I say that with great regret, because I do believe that the dismissive reaction of the liberal media to this is wholly unjustified. There is a lot here. This is a good example of good investigative reporting that has revealed the extent of corruption that was working. We know it was there. There's sufficient evidence for us, independent of the movie. The movie just adds to that evidence significantly. Mm-hmm. The real question is, could it be proved in a court of law? Could it be sufficient to overturn the election? And I think at this point, it would be very, 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 very hard to do so. It is always difficult to provide that ultimate proof. So you have a lot of smoke and you know there's a fire, but you can't actually pinpoint exactly where the fire is to the extent necessary to say that it would be enough votes to overturn the outcome of the election. Perhaps someday forensic abilities will be sufficient. We were largely unprepared for this going into the election. We have the information now, and boy, oh boy, those state legislators better get on it and better make sure that there's election integrity maintained by very strict requirements of proving through voter ID that an individual exists, that that's not a duplicate vote, that this isn't. And we've got to recognize that Trump has said all along that mail-in ballots are a recipe for corruption. Indeed, they were.
Yeah.
And California is just rife with this kind of corruption. You've got ballot harvesting lawful in California. People are bringing in votes that are Democratic Party operatives, are filling out ballots for people who got the information in the mail, taking it out of the mail. I mean, this is just massive corruption. Mm-hmm. And of course, the voting rights bill that the Democrats advocated that went down, fortunately, would have done the same thing writ large all across the nation, would have federalized the election system, even though the Constitution vests that power in the states. We've got to clean up the election system here. What this tells us is that in the 2022 midterms and forward, we've got to be very strict, because there are people out there looking to game this system. Mm-hmm. We have to be ready for it. We have to protect the integrity of the election process.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So real quick, in the time that we have left, I'd like to talk to you about the Durham investigation. We talked earlier about the Ministry of Truth. And speaking of disinformation, there is no greater, more clear example of disinformation than what Hillary did with the aid of our own FBI, CIA, NSA, and other intelligence agencies to concoct disinformation and spread it through the media. As part of that, the FBI was willing to set up and entrap Carter Page, George Papadopoulos, and others. And entrapment just now really seems to be the standard operating procedure at the FBI. So why is it that there seems to be okay for the FBI to plant evidence and use entrapment? I mean, how is this allowed to continue without a serious come-to-Jesus meeting at the DOJ and FBI?
Well, it has gotten way out of hand. I think the January 6th, ultimately, I suspect that the January 6th event at the Capitol is going to be shown to have been one that has had a lot of FBI involvement. We see that. We see evidence of that. But this sort of entrapment activity may well have happened, and individuals who are completely innocent may have been drawn into a net and given the badge of criminality and sentenced to jail. We'll have to see. Ultimately, history, I think, will tell on that point, because the evidence and the information is there. And when there's a new administration, hopefully a Republican administration, we'll see. And maybe that information will become public, and we'll see just the extent to which the FBI operatives were actually inducing people to enter into the Capitol building and so forth. But yes, this happens all the time. This is part of law enforcement, both at the federal and state level, and there are certain instances where, without question, use of a informant or a FBI agent or a police agent who is in a criminal organization and is revealing information secretly is helpful to protect the public and to ensure that justice is done. But when they as they did in the case of the mayor, or excuse me, the governor of Governor Whitmer. They can go too far. Yeah. And in that case, they concocted a crime.
Yes.
And then they induced someone to show interest in it.
Yeah. And that just seems to be such a shock, really, when it comes to our own FBI, that they are actually setting people up, concocting crimes rather than solving crimes. Jonathan, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great, as always.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
There is so much out there going on that is unconstitutional, one breach of trust after another by every element of government. Think about it. Is there any government agency that you trust right now? I can't think of one. This Tuesday is Election Day here in Oregon, and whether you're listening in Oregon or another state, I hope, if nothing else, this show convinces you to vote for candidates who are not established, previously elected politicians. Yes, there are a few good ones, but the vast majority of previously elected politicians need to be driven out. What we need is a new crop who are not beholden to the system nor have ties to it, who will have the will, the backbone, and the moral compass to go into the system and start pulling it apart. The FDA, the CDC, the FBI, the DOJ, and so many others. Only outsiders will be more willing to do that. Some, like Jim Jordan in the House or Ron Johnson in the Senate, have been trying to pull apart the system. But now we need dozens and dozens and dozens more like them. We can't just go in and tweak a few things. We have to have a system-wide do-over by people who aren't emotionally, politically, or financially tied to it. It's time for a full reboot. Keep that in mind this primary season and in the general, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.